This is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Thanks so much for listening. You can follow me online on my website, harrisonline.com, or on Twitter, at Paul Harris Show. I came across a fascinating book a few weeks ago. It is a book about the history of the things that have gotten us to where we are today. It's called 50 Inventions That Shaped the Modern Economy, and it's written by Tim Harford, who is an award-winning journalist and economist and broadcaster. He's got his own show on the BBC and joins us now from Oxford, England. Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for joining us. I was thinking during the newscast here at the top of the hour about the people in Puerto Rico who, you know, they have no electricity. They've got no water. They've got no fuel. They've got none of the things that modern life requires. I'm wondering how many of the things in your list of 50 inventions would even apply to people who are living such a non-basic lifestyle now.
Yeah, I mean, you are right. When I think about the things that we take for granted, so one of the things in the book is the simple S-bends that, you know, connects our lavatories to the sewage systems, you know, the water to take it away, the cold chain. So the idea that you can take food from anywhere on the planet and put it in a freezer, refrigerated ship, put it in a refrigerated truck, and finally put it in your home in a fridge. And you know the ability to do that completely depends on electricity. Our lives have been completely transformed by the availability of some of these inventions.
And some of them are really, really basic. I mean, you have things in here that if I were making the list, I wouldn't have even thought of putting in concrete.
Oh, yeah. No, don't disrespect concrete. Concrete is an amazing invention.
Oh, I'm not disrespecting. As a matter of fact, I know that in Las Vegas, the biggest convention of the year, the one that draws the most people every year, on the order of 150,000 people, is the concrete convention.
Yeah, well, they should rebrand it. They should call it liquid stone. I mean, it is amazing stuff. And it is, of all the materials that human beings use, with the exception of water, we use more concrete than anything else. It is a completely ubiquitous invention, and of course they're using a lot in China. So they've poured more concrete now, every 3 or 4 years in China in the last few years than was poured in the United States in the entire 20th century.
Wow!
I checked that one twice, that particular statistic, but it is amazing how ubiquitous this material has become. But what we don't recognize is also how old it is. I mean, the Romans were using concrete 2,000 years ago. There's evidence of concrete in Turkey and Syria 7,000, 8,000, maybe 10,000 years ago.
Wow.
It's a very, very old technology indeed.
Do we know who specifically invented concrete?
No, and that's true of a lot of the inventions in the book. This is not a book about stories of inventors, although there are some in the book. It's more about how these inventions have really seeped into everything and radically reshaped the way the world works. So one of the stories I tell in the chapter on concrete is of a poverty reduction program in Mexico, whereas you think, okay, you're going to try and help poor people in Mexico. What do you give them? Maybe flour for tortilla. Maybe you give them vaccinations. Maybe you give them cash. But no. This project was we give them ready-mix concrete, and the concrete mixer truck drives up to the front door. The delivery has been arranged, and they just pour the concrete out into the front room. The family will smooth it out. They'll wait for it to dry, and there you've got a hygienic surface on the floor of your home, which previously it was just packed dirt,
mm-hmm.
and the kids would pick up infections and parasitic worms. And so we've got this invention that, you know, we think of as totally unglamorous that can completely transform lives if it's used in the right way.
Yeah. Speaking of transforming lives, here in St. Louis, we are winding down a heat wave of I don't even know how many days in a row where it's been over 90 degrees.
And, oh, that's hot.
And one of the things that you have pictured on the cover of your book is the air conditioner. And every summer, I say a little private thank you to a guy named Willis Carrier, who never actually planned to make people cooler.
Yeah, no, he was trying to air condition rooms where printing presses were operating. Because if you want to print in color, you need to run the paper through the printing press several times for different inks. And if the paper changes in size because it's absorbed a bit of moisture, it doesn't work. It's out of alignment. It just looks terrible. And so he was employed to figure out a way of stripping the moisture out of the air, which is why we don't call it air cooling. We call it air conditioning. Mm. But he pretty soon noticed that people loved to be in the room with the printing press because it was not only was it less humid, but it was also cooler.
Yeah.
So, you know, he caught on fast. But when you start to think about it, the different impacts it's had. So Stephen Johnson, who's a great writer about technology, he argues that air conditioning helped to elect Ronald Reagan because it shifted the center of gravity towards places like Florida. Suddenly people are retiring to Florida, where previously it would just have been uncomfortable. People wouldn't, or Arizona, people just wouldn't have wanted to go there. Or another thing air conditioning does is it makes possible Google and Facebook. All of these server farms, all of these computers that are just in these huge warehouses somewhere, it's all air conditioned. You just couldn't make modern computers work without air conditioning.
Right.
Skyscrapers, not possible without air conditioning. Big glass buildings in places like Dubai or Singapore, forget it. So at first we just think, oh, it's nice. And as you say, in a heat wave, it's 90 degrees. It's nice to have air conditioning. But it shaped the world in all kinds of more subtle ways.
Very interesting. You mentioned paper with the Willis Carrier air conditioning connection. Tim, when do I get my paperless society? I was promised 20 years.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of a punchline, isn't it? Actually, more than 20 years ago, Thomas Edison thought that his phonograph was going to, this is a precursor to the gramophone, was going to replace paper. He thought people would dictate to each other on wax cylinders, and so no more paper. So people have been predicting this for a while. I have to say, paper is one of my favorite inventions in the whole book. It is partly the fact that it stands for the invention that won't go away. So there are other examples. The bicycle, for example. The world still produces many more bicycles than automobiles. But we focus on the auto. We forget about the bike. So paper is an example of that. But it's also an example of how a really simple, humble technology can be transformative. So when I was working on the book, people said, oh, you must write about the Gutenberg printing press. It gave us textbooks and novels and newspapers, and it's a completely transformative invention. It's about 500 years old. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, well, yeah, the printing press is important, but the printing press doesn't really make any sense without paper. You can print on other surfaces. You can print on animal skin parchment. But economically, it makes no sense. You need a really cheap, mass-produced writing surface before it makes any sense to mass-produce writing. And that writing surface is paper. So, you know, I wanted to give a shout-out to some of the simple, cheap stuff that we take for granted.
Well, I think it's very smart of you to give a shout-out to the product that makes up your book.
Yeah, the book. But also, you know, every time my children spill their breakfast cereal on the table, or every time I go to the lavatory, you know, I'm grateful for paper. It's not just for writing on. It's a very, very versatile material.
Well,
cardboard cartons, wallpaper, posters, photographic paper. It's all around us.
The book is called 50 Inventions That Shaped the Modern Economy. This is Tim Harford. Will we look back someday, talk about transformative technologies, can you see a day in the not-too-distant future when we will look back and say, boy, I'm glad we did more of that robot thing?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, even the definition of what a robot means, I think, is up for grabs. So for a lot of software engineers, when they talk about a bot, they're not talking about something like, you know, R2-D2, C-3PO from Star Wars. They're talking about just a piece of software, like an app, that automates some process that you're not thinking about, mm-hmm. not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact of these things is not always straightforward. So when the spreadsheet, for example, was invented in the late 1970s, it replaced pen and paper calculations done by accountants. Who would literally, they would crawl over these huge paper spreadsheets and just erase number after number after number and recalculate and write in the revised calculations. Along comes the digital spreadsheet, which is a kind of robot, right? It does, it automates arithmetic, and it replaces all of these jobs. But accountancy has as many jobs as it ever did. The accountants are just doing new things. They're doing more creative, well, maybe I shouldn't say creative accountants, but you know what I mean. You know, more advanced, more analytical work, less of this, you know, straightforward rubbing out and recalculating. So it's not that robots come and just take jobs. It's not as simple as that. They tend to take tasks away from people. And some of the tasks they take away are incredibly boring, but other tasks can be the fun stuff that we miss when the robots take them.
But whenever,
one of the robots I discuss in the book is called the Jennifer Unit, and the Jennifer Unit is just a voice in your ear. It's like a headset, and it's worn by warehouse workers. So they're going around warehouses, you know, Amazon warehouses or whatever. They're picking stuff off shelves. They're putting it in crates, and the Jennifer Unit is telling them where to go, how many to pick off the shelf, and so. That invention has turned the human beings into a kind of flesh robot.
Right.
We need your clever fingers and we need your eyes, but we don't need your brain. We can outsource your brain to software. So that's a very depressing vision of the future.
Yeah, we also have things like in the auto industry where robots are now building a lot of our cars. Michigan has more robots than any other place in the United States, and in fact, perhaps the world, because of the auto industry there. And that has taken a lot of people, a lot of UAW union guys and women, off the line, and they don't get to do that. Now, the argument is always, well, we can retrain those people to do other things that the robots are doing for them now. But that doesn't always happen, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, on a macro scale, the big picture scale, in the past, it has always been that we've always had more jobs. But on the micro scale, when you look at an individual industry, people have always been damaged by new technologies, and you could never take it for granted that people would get back the good jobs that they had. And we can go way back to the Luddites to see this. The Luddites were a political movement. They were people who smashed early machines in the English textile industry. And these days, when you call someone a Luddite, it's like an insult. It's like, oh, you don't get it. You don't understand technology.
Right.
The Luddites, they understood technology. They understood that those machines were going to destroy their livelihoods. And those machines did destroy their livelihoods. And, of course, 200 years on, we're all better off as a result of the technology. And no one now thinks, oh, if only people hand-wove cotton. But, you know, we can't minimize the disruption and the pain that it causes to individuals.
You're saying in the short term, technological advances are bad, but in the long term, we can view them later as good?
I think it's more complex than that. In the short term, and for an individual in an industry or for a narrow group of people, they can be bad. And for the society as a whole, they tend to be good, but they're almost always winners and losers.
Yeah.
So the gramophone, for example, big gains for people at the top of the pop industry because they can reach a global market, losses for people further down that industry because who wants to buy a record of the 20th best opera singer in the world? You know, previously, being the 20th best opera singer in the world is a good living, but now, you know, why don't you just buy a record of the best? And, of course, consumers gain. So that's a technology where within the industry, some people are doing great, some people are doing terrible, and it's because the technology has shifted, consumers are benefiting. But then, you know, people's jobs are important.
All right, now I've got to ask you to tell me a story directly out of the book. I want you to tell the story of the device that is around today because someone wanted to invent a death ray.
Yeah, so the commission was, the original commission was, can you invent a device that will raise the temperature of 8 pints of water by about 5 degrees at a range of 1 mile? And two British engineers were given this job in the 1930s, and they immediately knew what was being discussed. Like 8 pints of blood, 8 pints of water, well, that's 8 pints of blood. That's the amount of blood in a human body. So can we invent a ray that can raise somebody's body temperature by 5 degrees, which will knock them out, which if they're flying an aeroplane, will be fatal? And these two guys, Skip Wilkins and Oh, I've drawn a blank on the Robert Watson Watt, Skip Wilkinson, Robert Watson Watt. They discuss it and they decide, no, it's not going to work. There'll never be enough power. But you know what would work? We could send out the radio waves, and they would bounce off an aeroplane, and we could build a detector that would detect them bouncing off, and we could spot distant aeroplanes coming. Hugely important military technology. The British made a big advance just before the war, and then there's this great story of trying to get the radar technology across the Atlantic Ocean. What happens if the German submarines sink it? How do we smuggle it across? Gets to America in Boston, Massachusetts. Rad Lab is formed, and the American scientists make more advanced versions. And this is the technology that won the Second World War. The atomic bomb ended the war, but it was radar that won the war. And it's funny how long it then took to enter civilian aviation. People, at first in the 50s, people were like, well, you know, just the sky's a big place. Just don't crash into anybody. But there was a terrible, terrible accident over the Grand Canyon. Two planes, with cloud, trying to fly over the Grand Canyon and show their passengers a nice view of the Grand Canyon, hit each other, everybody's dead. And at that point, people started to go, you know what? This radar thing, maybe we could use it for civilian aviation as well.
Yeah.
So that's one of the inventions that shaped the modern economy.
So, yeah, we could work on this invention that would kill people from a mile away, but we could also come up with an invention that would keep people from dying when they get really, really close in the middle of the sky. Yeah, let's go with that one.
Yeah, well, you know, in wartime, people have certain priorities, and then sometimes in peacetime, things aren't quite so urgent.
In the book, you write about and discuss, I love this, on page 278, a question that's asked by another economist named Timothy Taylor to his college students, which is, would you rather be making $70,000 a year now or $70,000 a year in the year 1900? Now, of course, in 1900, $70,000 was a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, you would think if you were making $70,000 a year in 1900, you're a millionaire, right? Not literally, but...
Probably the equivalent of a couple million dollars a year now, right?
Yeah, easily. I mean, there are different ways to do the calculation, but it's a lot of money. You servants, big house, you know, a mansion, a chauffeur, the best car money can buy, all of that stuff. But the reason, I mean, very high status. You'd be one of the richest people in your city on $70,000 a year. But when Timothy Taylor gets his students to reflect on the question, which I think is why it's such a great question, they think, well, hang on, no computer games, pretty bad food. I mean, I'd get the best of everything, but the best of everything in 1900, you know, there's no Mexican food, there's no Indian food, there's no pizza, there's no air conditioning, the house is hot, there's no real nice, reliable showers. The car, I mean, the best car in the world in 1900 is not a good car. It's unreliable. It's uncomfortable. The place stinks. There's no washing machines. And you start working through it. You go, you know what? Actually, maybe $70,000 a year today, which is just a modest, plenty of money, but it's not millionaire money. Maybe that would be nicer.
Yeah.
And then you think to yourself, well, in that case, this inflation adjustment that we perform that turns $70,000 a year into millions of dollars, what is that actually measuring? It may be measuring the changes in price, but it's missing something about the quality of the products. Antibacterial agents like penicillin.
Yeah.
Missing that stuff out, vaccines, the telephone, you realize, maybe we have a lot to be grateful for in the modern world. We've got loads of problems. Lots of things, we don't want to be complacent, but the people who came before us were brilliant, were creative, they made amazing advances, and there's a lot that we should notice and practice some gratitude for.
That's a great perspective on how modern life is so much better, that even if you had all that money 100, 120 years ago, you know, you'd only live until you're about 42 years old. So, not so much with the exciting, happy life forever. One last thing I've got to ask you about, Tim. You do not delineate in the book which inventions are better than other inventions. You don't go through a list of the top 50 from 50 to 1, Casey Kasem countdown style. But I do have to ask you, what is, to you, Tim Harford, the number one invention of all time?
My favorite, I've already mentioned, is paper. Mm-hmm. But if I was going to say the one that started it all off, and it's the one I begin the book with, is the plow. Because the plow made it possible to generate an agricultural surplus. You know, cereals that you grew every year, you put in a barn, and then once you've got them stored in a barn, somebody else can start doing things like taxing you. Armies can be raised. They can go and steal someone else's grain. You get civilizations, religions, cities, accountancy, culture, all this stuff, all kinds of bad stuff, all kinds of great stuff. It's all built on the plow. Everything, really, the good and the bad, starts with the plow. And so I think that is the invention. You'd have to say that's the number one thing.
Okay, that's a good answer, but I'm going to give you some advice here as host to guest. Next time somebody asks you the number one invention of all time, you should tell them Amazon, because that's where you can order my book, 50 Inventions That Shaped the Modern Economy.
It's a great tip.
Tim Harford, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.